This is GM Authority Weekly, episode 70, recorded on August 3rd, 2011. The Horrible Cafe. GM Authority Weekly is brought to you by the GM Authority News Desk for the latest independent General Motors news, analysis, and a whole lot more. Visit gmauthority.com. You can subscribe to this podcast for free. Try searching for GM Authority Weekly in the iTunes Store. Welcome to GM Authority Weekly, the show that covers the GM news from the week that passed. And as we enter the summer months, the automotive news kind of dies down and the news churn comes to a halt. And, you know, car junkies are left picking their noses, so to speak. But there's still some GM news to discuss. But before we do that, I'd like to introduce this week's co-host, starting with the one and the only Manoli Katakis, GM Authority Editor-in-Chief. Good evening, Manny. How's it going?
Well, it's been pretty exciting past couple of days. I just got invited to the Michigan Gumball Rally to basically assist in the photography. And it's, for those of you that have heard about it, you know what it is. But basically, if you've ever heard of the Gumball 3000 in Europe, the Michigan Gumball Rally is basically like a miniature version of that. We tour Michigan. We start like just outside of Detroit. And we go all the way up to like around Traverse City and then to the Upper Peninsula. We stay there for a night and we come back down. For those of you that have seen the TV show Bull Run, it's basically kind of the same concept.
Cool.
It's going to be fun.
Have fun this weekend, huh?
This weekend.
There you go. And of course, we have, as usual, Hilton Jorson of GM Authority Opinion Desk fame. Hey, Hilton, how's it going?
Good. Unfortunately, my weekend won't be as fun as Manny's, but someday I hope to get a take that prize money.
How much is the prize money? What is it, like $15,000, $10,000?
It's an estimated $15,000.
So what's the entry cost of entry?
A grand.
So a grand a driver. How many vehicles total?
I haven't checked on the full registration list, but I mean, it's like unlimited. I'm not even sure. I think there's a limited number of seats, but I think there's a few still open. The most eye-catching car I think of that whole lineup has got to be the fire breather Camaro that's on the roster.
Now that belongs to the founder of the event.
Yeah,
right?
The founder of the event. It was the movie car. It's model number 00.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
But it's also beaten to hell because it was the movie car.
Yeah, I can imagine. Those things go through some very, usually they just have a body, you know,
right,
or a shell over some kind of a, you know, completely different vehicle.
The prize money, by the way, the prize money is $15,000, but bail's $14,000, so that's good.
That's funny, which you'll probably need. Yeah. So let's talk about the GM Authority Garage. We have, or I have, I should say, a non-GM vehicle in the garage this week, but it's still relevant.
What?
Yep. It's still relevant because it happens to be the primary competitor to the Chevy Camaro. That, of course, is the Mustang. So I had in the GM Authority, well, I guess not really in the GM Authority garage because I kind of stole it off my Ford buddies. It's a 2012 Ford Mustang 5.0. It was a stick, pretty much loaded. I think it had up to the 302A spec or rapid spec package, whatever that's called. Leather, the whole nine. I'll tell you what, first impressions. And the funny thing is, before I go any further, I want to say that the week before this, the few days that before I drove this car, I had the 2011 Camaro 1 SS. So these are kind of back-to-back comparisons. But first of all, visibility. You know, I could see out of the Camaro just fine after spending a good, you know, few days with it. And you kind of get used to the high belt line and kind of the low roof line and the, you know, thick A-pillars and lack of visibility in the Camaro. You kind of get used to it after a few days, but there's none of that kind of break-in period with the Stang. You just get in, you see everything, everything's pretty much open. It's, you know, the A-pillars are upright. They're not kind of sloping, you know, down. You know, plenty of visibility. So that's kind of one major factor that is a difference between the two cars. The other one is, of course, weight. And Manny, you and I have talked about this.
The Mustang kind of has that refinement that you get for not discontinuing a model for, you know,
right,
5, 6, almost 10 years.
Right, exactly. It's, this car is, what, 300 pounds, something, 300 pounds lighter than the Camaro, you know, mm-hmm. On a, you know, V6 to V6, V8 to V8 basis. And, you know, you feel it. It's I felt it at every single turn, every single acceleration, you know, stoplight, you know, get up and go. Everything is, it's just lighter, and it's something that you really, as a driver, and obviously both cars are driver's cars, you really feel this in both respects. So when you, you know, for example, take a hard turn, you know, the front doesn't tend to slide out as much as it does in the Camaro. I took the same routes with both cars and around the Pikes Peak area. So, you know, it's pretty much apples to apples here, but, you know, it's just a lighter car. Everything else, you know, I'd say that, you know, since I am on a kind of a dinging streak for the Camaro, the interior, it's soft touch materials up and down. You know, there's nothing hard touch about it, except for a very few areas that don't really matter where you really wouldn't even look. And of course, it has a nav screen, something that the Camaro doesn't even offer as an option. So, you know, all that put together, you know, pretty good package. I think the one I drove stickered at $42,000. It had some optional wheels, and it had I think it's called the California package, the California special package as well. So it looked quite a bit different than all the other Stangs, but you know, it's a good car. I can't really hate on it as much as I'd like to. That's all I got. What do you guys think?
Well, I just got a couple questions about how you like the fixed axle rather than the independent rear suspension.
You know, I really didn't notice. And I think it's one of those things that you notice only when you're on a track or if you're putting down like 1,000 horsepower,
mm-hmm.
You know, I know that the performance guys, the tuning crowd, you know, the guys who like to put in, you know, above 700 horsepower in their pony cars, they prefer the solid rear axle because it doesn't buckle, it doesn't flex as much as the independent rear suspension on the Camaro. And that's been a common, you know, down point, if you will, on the Camaro. You know, when you got guys putting in superchargers and just completely, you know, redoing their engines, you know, they want a solid rear axle, a fixed rear axle that doesn't flex, and you know, it feels more stable at those higher power numbers. But as far as just daily driving is concerned, and I didn't baby it. I took it up to a certain triple digit speed limit or speed, if you will. Yeah, it just feels as stable as the Camaro. You know, and funny thing is, the Camaro is a few inches wider than the Mustang, and it's also a few inches longer. Mm-hmm. It also has a longer wheelbase. I looked it up when I was doing the comparisons yesterday, and the heft of the Camaro and its bigger proportions kind of make it more, I don't want to use the word stable, but you just feel like you're going to be thrown around less. You know, when there's bumps, you know, here in Colorado, there's, you know, if you go up Pikes Peak, there's quite a few bumps and kind of, you know, unrefined pavement. And you just feel like you get thrown around less because it's kind of a, you know, a wider stance. So that's one thing that I did notice when I drove the two on the same course. But otherwise, yeah, I didn't really notice the difference that much. The one thing that I did notice, though, was you know, I'm really not a fan of the styling of the Mustang. You know, I still love the way the Camaro looks. You know, and I assume that a lot of people, you know, Hilton, maybe you're in this camp as well. You know, one of the reasons why you buy the Camaro is the way that it looks. You know,
Looks sells.
Exactly.
You know, you just have to take a look at women, guys.
Yep.
Best looking people sell more than the ugly people.
I think I would call the Mustang ugly. It's just not as good looking. You know.
Well, I think it's, you know, some. I mean, with a lot of cars today, I mean, they come out like their basic shape and design is so much more, I guess, there's so much more work or thought into the overall design of the car that when you get to the last mile of the finishing off of the car, it's easy to overdo it. You know, or jump the shark, as they say. You know, you want to be able to deliver something that's attractive to the eye, and not go overboard. And I think with the Mustang, particularly the Shelby with the front end that looks like a sockeye salmon lips or something. You know, it's kind of overdoing it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
You know, with the front, it's got these, you know, it's got this weird sort of trim piece, mm-hmm. you know, in front of the hood.
I had that actually, I think.
Well, it just looks worse than, it doesn't look good compared to the stock GT. I think overdoing.
The thing that I really don't like myself, and it starts in the front, what's up with those fog lamps that are right in the middle of the grill? You know,
well,
why can't they position them below? I understand it's a heritage
thing. That's classic
thing.
Mustang thing, yeah.
I understand
yeah.
that, but it's just so tacky to me. It just seems very useless, for lack of a better word.
I like them.
Well, it is, I do too, but then again, you know, I remember back in the day and it I don't know, fits the, goes back to the heritage of it.
Hilton, this is coming from a guy that likes the look of the present Scion TC.
Hold on a second. Let's not twist words and mince words out of proportion here. I don't mind it as much as I minded the last one. The last one offended me. This one is more masculine. I like the Scion TC in the way that it's.
I hate the way the like the rear window like cuts off.
You don't like that?
I hate it. I hate everything about the TC.
Well, do you at least like it better than the old TC?
I was indifferent.
So if someone were to come up to you and say, which one would you take, you know, and you had to choose.
It was like it between like a no and a really no.
Well, but one of them is better, right? Right? That's all I'm saying.
They both have the same engine.
Listen, would I buy it? Yeah. Would I buy it? Would I buy a Scion TC? Hell no.
Hell no.
But, you know, it's an improvement. And as long as we can see an improvement there, that's, you know, that's all that counts. But once again, you know, $42,000, you know, on the upper end of the 5.0 of the GT Spectrum. But you know, I like the car. I you know, as a GM fan, I hate to admit it, but you know, I think this is something that a lot of people, a lot of Camaro drivers, a lot of Camaro fans are asking for, and that's, you know, either more power in the Camaro to make up for its hefty nature, or just a decrease in weight altogether. You know, it needs to lose. I understand it probably can't lose 300 to 400 pounds, you know, that the Mustang has on it, but I'd say anything counts. And if they can shave off 100 pounds, 150 pounds, even 125 pounds off the Camaro, that would be great.
Well, I will give, you know, one thing I will definitely give to Ford is, you know, the variety that they give the customer. You know, you've got your base GT package, and then you got the California special, you got the GT, you've got the Boss 302, you've got the Shelby, and by the way, the GT 350 or the Shelby or the GT 500, and you got the Super Snake, you know.
And then there's a whole bunch of you know, the Saline stuff and the
yeah, but that's, you know, third party vendors. And then there's the Ford also offers a race only product, That is just
yeah, what's that called, Manny?
Just a crazy machine.
Super Snake or something?
Cobra Jet.
Cobra Jet, that's it.
Yeah. Cobra Jet, yeah. So,
yeah, it runs like a sub-11 there, or something.
And,
like that.
You know, the Boss 302, that package that they just come out with, is just a fantastic package. Bang for the buck. The car's just, it's into the 11s. Guys are getting it into the 11s. One thing I do like about that package, and I hope Chevrolet does something similar with the ZL1, is they actually have a track pack, and what it is really a tune. Go into the dealership and they give you a different key, which automatically triggers a different tune in the computer. Well, you go in the dealer, they do a change in the computer, but what it ends up doing is gives the car a nastier exhaust tone, nastier idle, and a few more ponies. So that's a neat little thing that you can do. I mean, it's when you think about it, you know, the computer today can offer has the ability for automotive companies to offer an additional RPO, such as you can have the fuel economy RPO, and you charge the customer $200 or whatever, and all you're doing is doing a tune. Or you can have a high performance RPO package, and again, it's just a tune, but you're making money.
Yeah, you know,
nothing more than changing parameters in the computer.
Right. You know, I would love to see something like that from GM on the Cruze. You know, where the current, can't remember what the real, what the exact number is, but I think the turbo in the 1.4 in the Cruze is something like, 4 or 5 PSI, you know, something negligible. You know, if you just double that, you know, even to 10 or 11 or 12, you know, that's going to at least give you 20, 30, 40 more horsepower. You know, and that's something that I would like to see as a Cruze owner.
Yeah, so you know, it gives you the ability to offer more to the customer and to dial in on specific customers' wants and needs without having to even manage, you know, configuration items in the plant. So it's a nice thing, I commend Ford for doing it.
Yeah, agreed. Well, nevertheless, that's the. That's the 2012 Mustang 5.0 for you. Do we miss anything? You guys, you have any more questions for me after driving this supposed Camaro eater? No? No? Nothing?
Whatever. Move on.
There you go. Let's talk about something that's very exciting, that this is a new story that we broke earlier today. And that, of course, is the Chevy Cruze hatch. The five-door variant will, in fact, we have this on good notice from a few of our internal sources who are very well connected and who have very, 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 very proven track records with us. And they say that Lordstown, Ohio, GM's plant, Lordstown, Ohio, is going to start making the Cruze hatch very soon. So basically, that means it's coming to North America. You know, obviously, this has been something that we've talked about to no end before. I think all three of us can agree that it's something that's needed in the U.S. market, if not really missing in the current lineup, in the current Cruze lineup. So, you know, hopefully this is going to materialize. Obviously, it's going to materialize now that it's going to be built in Lordstown. You know, good stuff, good car coming to the U.S., coming to Canada, hopefully to Mexico as well, North America in general. Good news?
Great news.
Finally, right?
Yeah. Well, we don't know how finally.
So we have a... you know, we have the hatch coming. Mm-hmm. We have the diesel-powered Cruze coming. Mm-hmm. We have a global refresh for the Cruze range for the 2014 model year. Mm-hmm. Is that?
We have the. Don't forget.
No,
the
it's not enough.
Turbo.
If that's what you're asking.
It's not enough. You want a coupe?
Don't forget the twin turbo Eco 4 that's coming.
What? Oh. What?
I'm just kidding.
See, he tricked us. We got to get him back.
Although, I mean, how hard could it be to strap on another snail shell on that thing?
Well,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at what expense? I guess is the question.
Well, you probably need an intercooler.
Right. Exactly.
At
that point, you really need one.
Yeah. Well, like, what I really want to see though is the turbo 1.6 in America's Cruise.
I want that to be the base engine.
Well, it doesn't need to be the base. At least be like a mid-range engine.
And then with a 2.0, would the diesel be the range topping?
No, if you want, it will be range topping in some respects, like right. torque and fuel economy. But if you want like all out, like performance, I mean, I'm still hoping that there's a 2-liter turbocharged Ecotec in the cards somewhere.
Yes, there must be. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, the Buick Regal Turbo. You've driven that car, right?
Yeah.
You had it in the GM Authority garage. You loved it. And that car is what, 600 pounds heavier than the Cruise?
Right. Yeah. And it was punchy, especially when you got it up to speed. But that's the problem too with like the Buick, the engine. It was too small. You know, it an engine like that. I mean, for being the like a range topping engine, like the top option, it's too small for a Buick because it's a compact car's engine in a midsize car.
But
you know
it's
I mean?
Not really the range topper because that high output
version.
Well,
the GS,
that,
yeah, right. You're still. I mean, 270 horsepower. But really, I mean, is that enough? Is that really a lot?
295 pound feet of torque, mate. I mean, that's.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to drive. Like I'm not expecting it to be disappointing, especially when the road gets a little twisty. But mm-hmm. I mean, on a straight line, and
I'll
just
tell you what,
from overall acceleration, it's just it's going to be. Maybe all right.
So I drove the Lexus ES 350 for a year and a half or something like that. 3.5 liter engine. I think it's 269, 270 horsepower, 240 something. I think 245 pound feet of torque. And that engine, when you've shifted over into the manumatic mode, was plenty in a straight line. You know, I was actually, and there's no way to turn off traction control in there because you know it's a Lexus and all that, but I was actually able to make the tires spin, you know, a few times. You know, it's fun. It's not as fun in the twisties because it wasn't really meant for handling, but it's more than enough. And I think 270 horses and 295 pound feet of torque will be more than plenty in the GS. And I'm kind of, you know. I'm kind of, at first I was surprised that it wasn't that 2.8 turbo, right, with the all-wheel drive system, with the Haldex all-wheel drive system. But, you know, now that I kind of see where they were going with this, I think it will be just fine. I think it will be more than enough. So, we'll see. I'd still like to see the 2-liter, even the low-output version that's in the Turbo Regal, not the GS, but the regular Turbo Regal in the Cruise as the range-topping engine.
But now, when they talked about the hatch coming to Lordstown, are we talking about the 5-door for now?
Yes.
Or did they mention 3-door?
No, we're talking about 5. Well, we're not. When I discussed this with a few of our sources, we didn't discuss the amount of doors, but we just, you know, we refer to it as the hatch. So I think it's universally understood that currently what a hatch means is that it's a 5-door hatch. Although. You know, a 3-door is something that I think is necessary as well. You know, if the Cruise
is
like
you know
range.
This. Well, I mean, the Cruise is you know, it's just a fantastic platform for working off of. You know, you have the opportunity to offer the world so many different variants. I mean, it's a decent sized car. It's not too big, and it's certainly not too small. It's got great gas. Good quality all around, and you know you can deliver a product that that can sell everywhere. You know, this is not a car that is a, you know, North American only type of vehicle. So You know, and it's selling like crazy as it is. Yeah, I mean, they're actually selling
more
as
than
many
anyone.
As they can make.
Well,
so, yeah.
Well, in the segment, yeah, by far in the segment.
Right. You know, since I've owned one for the last, 5 or 6 months or so. And the thing about the Cruise is that I may have said this before. I'm going to say it again if I did. I apologize if I repeat myself. But it's just too good of a car to waste on that engine that's in there right now. It's too good of a car for that Econobox engine, for lack of a better word.
We're a minority again. It's like that Econobox engine is what's turning out to be
absolutely
sales pitch.
My question is, and I'll tell you what, I mean, I've driven the Cruise back to back with the Focus and the Elantra, and the Elantra is, as far as I'm concerned, it's not even a distant third. You know, it looks good from the outside. It's got a cool looking interior. It's got some decent interior materials, but from a driving perspective,
it's a tin can.
I wouldn't even call it that. It's like, have you guys heard of the problems that the Sonatas are having with the drift on the highways?
Vaguely.
These things, the Sonatas, this is not the Elantra, obviously, it's the midsizer. These things apparently have a problem where they drift from side to side. As you're driving at at a high speed, like 70 miles an hour or higher.
See, that sounds like fun if you were actually the one drifting the car.
Well, it's not fun because guess what? Like, what happens is, and I've experienced this myself, and I didn't know what it was. I thought I just had low tire pressure, mm-hmm. And it wasn't the case. I after reading this, I think there was a story on Jalopnik a few weeks ago about this, and they don't really know what to do because they can't issue a recall without there being any accidents, and there haven't been any accidents yet. But nevertheless, it's... what happens is you're driving, straight, let's say, and the car just suddenly starts to kind of veer a little bit, not suddenly, but just kind of slightly veer to the left or to the right, mostly to the left. And then every 30 seconds, 40 seconds, you have to correct it a little bit to the right. So you can imagine how annoying that gets, if you're driving for a good 30, 40, long trips, that's really annoying. So I don't think Hyundai is there yet as far as driving dynamics are concerned, as far as engineering. Maybe they've gotten in on looks. They've gotten on better on interior materials and quality. But I'll tell you what, the Cruise and the Focus is where it's at right now. And the Focus has one leg over the Cruise, and that's in the engine. It's got a 2-liter direct-injected engine. The 1.4 is not direct-injected in the Cruise. And there is plenty of low-end power in the Focus, and that's one thing that's really lacking in the Cruise. The amount of low-end power is just, it's non-existent. And you couple that with the fact that the Focus has a dual-clutch transmission where you don't even feel the shifts unless you're really flooring it. If you're just driving it regularly around town and, driving it like a regular person would, you don't even feel the shifts. It's that smooth, that DSG. Those are the two advantages the Focus has over the Cruise, and that's it for now. But the Cruise is outselling the Focus, right?
Oh, by like almost 10,000 units for July.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a factor of Ford not being able to make enough, or
from what Ford's presser said, it has a lot to do with a supply issue. And the Elantra, I'm not really sure why the Elantra is not selling, side to side with the Cruise. Cruise went 24,000, I think, for July, and the Elantra was like 14,000-15,000.
Yeah.
Like really just
significantly lower. Like a 340% increase for Hyundai.
Yeah.
But, the Cruise is definitely a runaway success, here in America, and
Second only to the Camry.
Second only to the Camry, that's right. And the Camry, yep. I mean, I just find it amazing. I don't know if you guys feel agree, but, the Camry has been in its current, top selling position for what, the last 5, 6, 7 years? And the Cruise is a brand new nameplate, new for 2011. And now it's already the second best selling car in America.
Mm-hmm.
Car, not truck. I think that's impressive. I think that's very impressive. So.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, yeah.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about sales numbers, let's
And you want to go more in depth?
Yeah, let's talk about that. So, overall in July 2011,
yeah, 7.6% gain for the month. Crossover vehicles posted the highest gains, especially I kind of saw it as a bit of a surprise cuz they weren't doing so well last month.
No.
It was basically all passenger cars really carrying GM last month. But anyway, yeah, they saw a 17% gain in crossovers. Total U.S. sales for July were 214,915 units. And year-to-date, GM's got 1,476,548 total unit sales. And they're leading the country in market share at around 20%.
Right. Now, Chevy still got outsold by Ford, you know, as when you're talking about mainstream brands, by something like 30,000, 25,000 units. Well,
Ford overall, I want to say, has like a more modern and stronger portfolio. Mm-hmm. Chevy, I mean, they have right now the Cruze.
Well, really, the oldest car in the Ford portfolio is the Fusion, and that's not a bad car at all. Whereas for Chevy, you have, you know, the Sonic isn't out yet. Mm-hmm. The Malibu is coming to the end of its life. You know,
yeah, well, it's going to be Impala, a half year.
Yeah, we all know what's up with the Impala. Mm-hmm. The trucks, the Suburban and the Tahoe.
Yep.
Both of those are really outdated compared to their Ford counterparts.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're looking at, well, I wouldn't even know, like, the Suburban is the Suburban. Like you don't see any other large vehicle like that competing with the Suburban, like at that kind of level. Like the Suburban, is far and away like the best selling full size SUV you can find.
The Expedition, it's called the EL or the XL. That's the same exact class. Same size, same dimensions, but it's just more modern. It has like an automatic or electric third row, electric second row. So you can just press a button and the seats will fold or come upright. Flat folding third row and second row as well. You know, something that Suburban and Tahoe don't have. So, you know, I mean, I love the way the Suburban looks, but, you know, feature by feature, again, Ford has kind of got the upper hand.
I think where the meat and potatoes is today is really about economical vehicles. I mean, Ford, and don't get me wrong, I mean, Chevrolet has really done an about face with respect to bringing out quality vehicles, and obviously their priority to market was focused on fuel efficiency like the Cruze, the Volt, and now the Sonic. But with Ford, it's almost like everything that they do now is really driven on fuel efficiency. Even their pickup trucks now are, you know, really focused on, you know, the six cylinder as opposed to the four cylinder. The Ford Explorer is now, they're selling as many as they can make. They've gone from a truck platform to a true crossover slash unibody type design.
Yeah, not only that, now they have that 2-liter engine in there as well, the 2-liter EcoBoost in an Explorer.
Yeah, and and so really focus on fuel efficiency. And I think with, you know, this is the times we're in right now. We are in a time where you do not focus on wide margins on your products. You focus on trying to create market share and trying to deliver the best stuff on the planet. And with respect to General Motors, they have some really good stuff, but the problem now is not really on the sales side. The problem is on the supply side, the manufacturing side. They can't build enough Cruzes. They can't build enough Equinoxes or GMC Terrains. And so how do you go about to try and, increase supply? Now, you know, the one thing that I give credit to Diana Tremblay is that when they faced this problem a year ago, they made a decision to move partially built Equinoxes from the one plant and truck it over to the Oshawa plant for completion. Now they've got to start looking other ways to meet the needs of the North American market with respect to economical vehicles. They're with Cadillac, that ATS should have been to market right now. The Buick Verano and some degree, even a smaller Buick should have been to market right now. The Sonic has the ability to, I think, easily sell 10 to 12,000 units a month. Maybe even more.
Well, here's my question. Here's my question. I mean, the Sonic is a great car. I think it's as great of a car. Obviously, I think it's better than the Fiesta.
Well, we're expecting it to be.
Right. So, yes, that's a good point. I haven't driven it. So, here's the deal. The Fiesta, which is also an excellent vehicle, gets great fuel economy, only sells, you know, in a 5,000 unit range, like in
yeah,
July.
Well, yeah, it hasn't caught on as much as we'd like
In July, 5,296. That's it. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a sizable increase.
How long
has
it been on the market?
At least a year and
it's, yeah,
four
about
months,
a year.
5 months?
Yeah.
Where's that built?
Mexico.
Yeah. So.
Now, well, let's get back on target, though. We got to wrap up the sales numbers up.
We do? Is somebody
yes.
rushing you?
Well, if we want to save time for what we have in store.
Oh, that's what's rushing you. All right. So let's talk about Buick.
Buick, pretty much, I mean, they were flat.
0.04%. No, excuse me, 0.04%.
Yeah. And you know what? That's funny. That 0.04% also marks a 22-month streak for positive sales gains, even though it was, you know, completely minute.
Hey, somebody got their bonus.
Well, hey, you got to look at what happened last year. Last year, they at the same time, July 2010, they posted 136% gain, and so yeah, how long can you keep such an explosive gain going? Well, at least now they're at the same, like, you know, level of sales.
Yeah,
as
well,
last
I mean,
year.
Yeah, but the one thing about that is it's like Chrysler can do similar numbers when you're. You know, when you're only selling one or two products, it's easy to double the sales of next year's by introducing something new. You know, it's like when the ATS comes out, you know, all of a sudden 100.
Well, I want to see what's going to happen even newer with the updated SRX that's coming to market this month in August. But another reason why Buick is kind of flat this month is because of Lucerne. And that it's, I mean, they're putting it out to pasture. So whatever left they have in the inventory, they're just selling it. So you saw a 59% sales drop in the Lucerne, but the Enclave saw 21.9% increase, and
that's
you had
surprising.
About 16,873 total unit sales.
Yeah.
Not so surprising though was the way Cadillac just kind of spiraled downhill 25.5%. And again, that is also relative to losing the SRX or the STS and DTS and only having the Escalade, the SRX, and the CTS, you know, for the customers.
So that's
it's
it.
Just
they,
not
they're,
enough
they're,
right now.
They're basically down to three models.
Yeah. Well, it's only uphill from here. You're going to get, you know, you got that updated SRX on the way, and then you have the XTS, then you have the ATS, which are both going to launch in the same year, you know, one in the beginning, one at the end. And, you know, onward, we're still expecting that Lambda-based Cadillac. You have the next generation Escalade probably hitting market sometime in 2014, late 2014 possibly. And, you know, just so on and so forth. And, you know, whatever variants they want to throw in there along the way. Next generation CTS by then also, you know, you're looking at 2013.
Somebody told me today that they want to see an El Camino version of the next generation CTS. And I kind of looked at them and...
They were crazy?
Yeah, I really wanted to smack them over the head. I was at that point holding my...
No, do you remember the M3 pickup?
I do.
Wouldn't that be like a great April Fool's joke?
That would be kind of funny.
but it wouldn't be as funny because it's like, oh, BMW already did it. Ha,
right,
ha, ha.
Right. Yeah, this person kind of, I was like, really? You, what do you currently drive? Do you like, do you drive the Flintstones mobile? Is that the case? What's
right.
going on there?
Well, it would definitely have been it would be a mobile conversation piece for sure.
Yeah. You,
so bottom line.
If that's what you call it.
Just to wrap up the sales.
Oh, wait, we didn't do GMC yet. Hold on a sec.
Okay. Well, yeah, GMC up 36.4%, basically all on the shoulders of the terrain. Carry on.
So, in a nutshell, or basically, you know, they're decent sales. They're doing okay. But, you know, there's no huge spike in their numbers. You know, there's nothing there that says, wow, they're kicking ass compared to, let's say, some of the growth we are seeing in, like, the Ford Explorer or even Chrysler, for example.
Right. Well, you know, you compare, like, Ford overall sales, which were up 9% in July. You know, GM was comparably up 7.6%. So, you know, I think those increases are comparable. Now, again, what I'd like to see is I'd like to have Chevy outsell Ford, you know, on a brand-by-brand basis. Not GM to Ford Motor Company, but Chevy to Ford brands. You know, right. At that point, GMC, Buick, and Cadillac are just gravy, you know.
Well, I mean, you've got – Chevy is also going to be suffering a lot in its lineup, especially in the next couple of years, because all they're going to have – all the money right now is just going to their compact and midsize vehicles. So
no,
you're going to have –
Manoli, I think that the Impala is a fine vehicle. Okay.
Right. Well, yes, it's fine in terms of overall sales. It's definitely a
I'm just pulling your leg.
Right, but at the same time, the Equinox and the Traverse, from what I know, are not planning to get refreshed until the next generation model, which is ridiculous.
Oh, that's like what, 5 years out?
Yeah,
four or five years out.
It's gonna feel like the Impala by the time that they get around to it.
Oh man,
you know what I mean?
Oh man.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that didn't Ford recently mention that they were going to shorten the models.
Life cycle.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And look at them already. Yeah. They pretty much mastered the mid-cycle refresh. If they can shorten the development process or the new products, I mean, more power to them.
In effect, if you think about other Ford products like the Taurus, that's going to have two major mid-cycle refreshes before the all new model launches in the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Two major mid-cycle refreshes. You know that's huge.
You know, the least that Chevy could do, GM could do in respect to its crossovers, new engines.
Oh, absolutely.
At least new engines.
Absolutely. I don't know why.
Maybe they're on the way. Maybe we're gonna see the boosted EcoTech in the maybe in the Equinox. Maybe that's right. In the cards.
I think that if anything, those 3-liter LF1s. Just need to go. They need to go.
Or just strap a couple turbos on them and.
Yeah, whatever. Just either the LFX or the 2-liter turbo EcoTech. You know, uh-huh. One of those two, please. Because the Edge, for example, I mean, we keep talking about Ford and we keep coming back to it because they seem to be the technology leader right now. And you know, I'm sorry, but that's you know, I'd like to say otherwise, but it's not the case. You know, you have the Edge getting the 2-liter turbo. From Ford as well, the EcoBoost.
They're an engineering leader. I wouldn't call them technology leader.
Oh, come on. I mean, they have, outside of the pickup trucks maybe, but think about it. They have infotainment, the lead in infotainment. They are catching up quickly.
Which is getting terrible press right now.
Because those people don't know how to use a computer. But, you know, that's one thing. They're catching up very quickly to what OnStar is doing with their sync services platform. You know, so the infotainment and the telematics aspect they've got covered. You know, they're pumping the stuff out. I mean, engineering is where it's at. What else are you gonna? I mean, technology is engineering. I don't think there's even a debate.
Well,
there.
When you say engineering, I'm thinking engines, drivetrain,
vehicles,
chassis.
Just vehicles in general. I mean, better cabins. You know, soft edge materials.
That's all design.
Maybe.
Well, still, it all boils down to...
It matters to the consumer.
Yes.
And I think the quicker you do refresh some of your product, then, you know, the more consumers pay attention to you. And the older that your competition starts to look. So, you know...
And the more you can make fun of them.
Well, I don't know about that. But the bottom line is if they can deliver new refresh products sooner... They actually create a new competitive advantage because, you know, consumers start to look at
to keep that life cycle, shorten that life cycle of the products, and still be engineering leaders, then, you know, it bodes well for them in the future.
Yeah.
So I you know, when I hear this thing about the Taurus getting, you know, two mid-cycle refreshes, and you know, they're very quick on moving forward with the next version of the product, you know, I kind of compare that to, you know, why is it taking so long for this ATS to come out? Why is it taking so long for, you know, the XTS to come out? And, you know, why are they waiting so long for doing something with the Equinox and Terrain in the distant future anyways?
Yeah.
Well, you know, this probably has a lot to do with just money. Probably has a lot to do with, you know, right, just things that are behind closed doors that we, for more or less, wouldn't really know about otherwise.
Right. No, I agree. I think that's, you know, part of the government motor stigma comes a functional problem of, you know, the government bureaucracy. And, you know, at that point you have just, it's slower in general. And what I meant, by the way, just to come back for a sec about what I said before about Ford being able to make fun, so to speak, of GM products. Ford dealers are actually now encouraged to buy up Impalas and what else they want? The Impalas, and there's another one. I forgot what they want to compare it to, but and they basically they're encouraged to compare their Taurus to the Impala and kind of show people that Government Motors is, and this is a big part of their marketing literature internally. You know, Government Motors, this is what they did to GM, you know.
All right.
This is the Impala that you get, part of Government Motors. Thank you very much. Mm. So.
Well, I don't think right now they're, you know, that GM is that handcuffed.
No, but you know, they were for a certain amount of time, and that is what's showing, I think, what's going to be showing in the next 1, 2, 3 years. Primarily. All right, let's switch gears. Let's talk about something not so depressing, I guess. Let's talk about Big Brother and Family Link. This is OnStar's brand new service, and so what does this do? In a nutshell,
it basically lets you play Big Brother.
Yes, exactly. Two things. If and I like the way you put this, Manoli, in the article. Basically, it has two features. Vehicle locate and the ability to also set up scheduled email or text message notifications that provide the vehicle's location at a certain time during a day. That's also called vehicle location alert. So two services, part of Family Link, vehicle locate and vehicle location alert. So if, let's say, your son or daughter is taking your...
Those sound way too similar, you know what I mean?
Vehicle locate, vehicle location alert?
Yeah. Way too similar.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's part of the same service, so, you know, it's they're going to be marketing Family Link, not these two services separately. But so let's say use case scenario, right? Let's say you have a son or daughter, Hilton. You let your son borrow your Camaro, right?
Right.
To
yeah, right.
to take to the movies for the night, and
like, I'm going to buy my son a 1980 one-ton GMC pickup truck.
How about a Geo Tracker? I think those are pretty hot.
No, you like rollovers? You know, yeah. Well, I just want something that, you know, if he ends up in the ditch one night, he'll still be in one piece.
Oh, that's a good, yeah.
Get him a cruise, 10 airbags.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, the structural integrity.
You know what?
I
think, but yeah. Bottom line is, I think this is a great feature.
Well, we haven't discussed what it is yet. Hold on a sec.
Okay.
Wait. So let's say you your son does take the Camaro out for the night, and you just, you know, as a precaution, you want to check to see where the vehicle is at a certain point in time. So you pull it up online, you go to the OnStar website, you log in as you would to use any of their current services on there, and just kind of, you know, just say locate, click on locate, and it will locate the car. So that way you know if it's, Manny, I love the way you put this, if it's, you know, really parked outside of a local cinema, or if it's actually parked outside of a suspected meth lab.
You'll never know sometimes. Well, at the same time, like, they target it. They're marketing this like it's kind of like a parent observation feature, when really you could also say watch where your cheating spouse is going.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. But, well, I mean, you know, I guess it's one of those situations where should you be doing it if you are not that proud of it? But then again, you know, that's your choice, I guess. But so that's the major feature, and then the vehicle location alert. What that allows you to do is just set up a scheduled time where you will get an update of where your vehicle is, either by text message or by email, and you know, then you know if your kid, for example, has, you know, was actually taking your Camaro to school in the morning, or if he is, you know, I don't know, doing something else. Like hiding paraphernalia.
Trafficking.
But, I mean, we joke about this, but there really is another use case here. And that's if, let's say, you're driving or your significant other is driving in foul weather and, you know, snowstorm, you know, hurricane, I don't know, what have you. So you can just track and monitor their progress throughout their trip all the way through. And that way you know if everything's all right, or if you know, you don't hear from them, you don't hear back from them, you can tell the towing company exactly where they are because you can see their vehicle on the map.
Right. Well, if it's like in my case where it's you know, a 2-foot blizzard and it's going to take 2 hours regardless, even if they know the exact location or not.
Right. Well, at that point, you just need to call in a chopper and
it
maybe
sucked,
have...
man. When I crashed my old view.
Oh yeah. Man. Yeah.
How many I had nothing. I had nothing on except like my tennis shoes, gym shorts, and a t-shirt.
Yep.
Because obviously I wasn't expecting to get in a collision. I wasn't expecting a car to spin out from the other lane and into me. So
yeah. Yeah, those are tough, but glad you're okay. You know.
Yeah, yeah, I'm over it.
I you know, this reminds me, this entire service, there was a journalist who worked for CNET a few years ago, an Asian guy who, they were driving, they were making a cross-country trip during the winter, and they were stuck. They got stuck in a ditch. They lost control of the car, and it was him, his wife, and their newborn baby. And they got stuck in a ditch somewhere where practically nobody could see them. And he went out on foot. You know, they didn't have cell service. So he went out on foot to either, you know, track someone down or to, you know, to get cell service, cell reception. And unfortunately, he ended up dying as he was, you know, doing this because he ended up starving and just the snow was too hard. And
oh, wow.
His wife and kids survived, thankfully. But, you know, this is one of those services that, you know, it's really important to have in a situation
that. It's definitely like, I mean, there's a lot of positives here. And I'm sure, like, oh, by the way, this is only a pilot program. 10,
which
000,
I'm in.
Yeah, good. Only 10,000 active OnStar subscribers from now until the end of the year are basically going to be a part of this program. Mm-hmm. And basically judging on response, they're going to move forward or stop it, you know, I suspect one way or the other.
Yeah, I thought we'd keep it.
I think a lot of people are going to look at it and be like, oh, their tracking is too much control, blah, blah, blah. It's like, really? I mean, you already have...
Your cell phone is already doing that.
Yeah, your cell phone's already doing it. You have, you know, OnStar, even without this system, even without Family Link, it's already doing it. Right. I mean, really,
if there's a Big Brother scare here, all I got to say is this is already happening without Family Link. I mean, OnStar, if the U.S. government thought that you were a threat to society and needed to track down your vehicle, they will subpoena OnStar into providing your location. All right? It's very simple. It doesn't take that much. So this is already happening behind the scenes. It's just OnStar's choice to expose it to you as a user. And at that point, you know, this is a feature, this is a value add. The question is, do they charge extra for it? I say no.
Well, I think, you know, GM has to try and find a way to offer OnStar next to nothing, to be honest. And, you know, yeah, I don't want them to look at this as another way to make increase the revenue for OnStar. And the product, by the way, like the service, I think is great. I mean, I definitely when my kids are old enough to drive, I was looking, planning on doing something like this to track where they are.
With like a third party service?
Sure. I mean, I don't care. You know, it's important for me to keep to make sure that the kids are A, safe, and B, doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
And so I think it's a great service. I mean, you know, all the everything they need to offer it is already there anyways.
Yeah.
And, you know, and by the way, I mean, you know, cell phone companies can do the same thing. It's like you said, you know, if you're using, you know, any technology that uses phone towers,
triangulation,
guess what?
Baby.
Exactly. They'll know exactly where you are. Mm-hmm. It's just like people who sit on a computer and you think people have no idea you're sitting there posting on the internet, and you don't think people can find out who you are.
Oh, I mean, no, you don't know. You hide behind the anonymity of your screen when you do that. Nobody knows you're in your mom's basement in pajamas.
Yeah, well, as soon as I got your IP address, I can pretty much find where you are.
Exactly.
So it's the bottom line is, you know, it's I can understand people's anxiety about, you know, Big Brother looking over you, but it's just a service. You can opt in or opt out. It's not something that, you know, General Motors or OnStar has no desire or no need to see where you are.
They don't have a vested interest.
Exactly. It's just
but their primary shareholders do. I mean, I'm not trying to start a conspiracy or anything. I'm just being a smartass.
Well, no, their shareholders want them to make a profit on it. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to track you and use it for nefarious purposes.
There's nothing there that General Motors can make money off of by tracking you.
No, they're going to sell like where like Manoli is at all times. They're going to sell that data to some advertisers, and
in India,
right? And then they're going to call you, you know, around 2 a.m. or so, as you're coming back from one of those parties that you love to attend. And, you know, that's what's going to happen.
That's how I meet people.
That's exactly how you meet people. How else are you going to meet people? I mean, you got to sleep during the day. Jeez.
Yeah, all day.
There are things that GM can do to increase the efficiency of a vehicle by tracking certain things on the car.
Oh, yeah.
Like how long, you know, you
drive,
your braking distance, how long you sit at idle, how long, you know, how much.
They've already got that all like the black
the box. Gas.
Yeah,
exactly.
But, right. You know? I wonder if they transfer that during service.
No.
No. So this would be one way to do it.
Needed. Yeah, but
so
you know, like I said, there's nothing there.
Yeah, I mean,
that would suck though. Like, you know, you say you break the speed limit and all of a sudden you get a ticket in the mail. Even though no one pulls you over?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's...
feel like that's a very close
possibility. That happened to one of my friends back in Miami. They didn't know that they installed the light cams.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
They got a ticket in the mail. And it was like, what the heck?
Yeah, but like completely... I mean, you're not supposed to run red light anyway. That's very dangerous. But...
No.
Like,
well, you're not supposed to speed.
Empty highway, flat pavement.
Deer.
Whatever.
That's all I got to say. Deer.
Broad daylight.
Deer.
Clear line of sight.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Not to the left or right.
Don't talk to me about deer. I live in Michigan. I know deer.
Yeah. Well, it's still illegal, but, you know, I agree with that philosophy.
So.
You know, I think you're allowed to do whatever the hell you want to do as long as you don't impact other people. And if you accidentally kill yourself, well, you've actually create jobs. Sure, like you get an extra EMS out there.
Yeah, but then if you take that theory, then you decrease the demand of, you know, you're a person, because you're not going to be alive anymore. So the next day you're not going to go to Chipotle and buy food.
No, the demand's going to be even higher. It's just the supply is going to be.
No, the demand's going to be lower because you, in effect, you yourself have decreased that demand. Because think about it, next day. You would have, if you would have been alive, you would have gone to Chipotle, and you know, gotten a meal. You would have gotten a haircut. You would have gone to.
Yeah, but your family would. They all demand to see you, and you can't. Never mind. We're getting sad.
All right. Yeah.
We're getting very sad.
So bottom line, I have access to this. If you have any questions about this, just email us, podcast@gmauthority.com. I'll be more than happy to answer any questions you have about Family Link. In fact, I'm going to make a video in the next couple of days about this and how it works and kind of give you an overview. But it works as advertised. It doesn't pinpoint it exactly. It gives you a radius on a map of where the vehicle is. So it doesn't say, like, your vehicle is exactly to the mile, you know, to the inch right there. Kind of says, kind of puts a circle around where your vehicle is and says your vehicle is in this vicinity. So it's not freakishly accurate, but it's accurate enough. So here's the question, Manoli. Mm-hmm. Do we talk about CAFE regulations or do we talk granite?
We have, ooh.
I don't want to talk CAFE.
No CAFE.
Can we touch base on it? Just we got to.
Okay.
Just the numbers.
Okay. Just the
you
numbers.
You got a minute.
All right. 54.5 miles per gallon, average corporate fuel economy with...
Wait, how much?
54.5 miles per gallon,
well, that's
corporate,
like,
fleet average by 2025.
Right.
And that is going to be basically composing of a targeted 62 miles per gallon for cars and 44 miles per gallon for light trucks. Basically, you know, your Silverado 1500s, 2500s, 3500s, you know. Actually, I don't even know if by then 3500s might be in the medium duty segment. Or, you know, as far
right,
as
right.
You know, classification goes, for real. You know, and but that also, the 44 MPG also applies to full-size vans like the Express and SUVs like the Suburban. And these numbers are basically, they're double the current standards of what's in place today. And if you do the math, it's a 5% annual increase in efficiency starting the year 2017. Now, the results of which will hopefully stem America's reliance on foreign oil by an estimated 2 million barrels of oil per day, as well as saving consumers money at the pump. But will they really? Because, you know, you get the cheap, you know, more fuel economy, they want to drive more, whatever. I'm not even going to get into it. So while, you know, GM is basically fully aboard these mandates, you know, they're not kicking and screaming about it. And, you know, the same old PR spiel you've heard before, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we're looking forward to the challenge, blah blah blah. But, you know, some speculate that it's just going to be too expensive for consumers and that it's going to severely cripple the new car market, developers. I don't know, we could go on about it is really more of a controversy than anything right now, because you got a lot of people that are just saying, you know, oh, of course I want to see, you know, 62 miles per gallon in my car, that'd be great. It's like, but at what cost, at what sacrifice? So,
well, this is really, really interesting. I mean, 62 miles per gallon for cars, 44 miles per gallon for trucks, corporate fleet average of 54.5 miles per gallon. That's quite an increase. I mean, at that point, everyone is driving a Prius, right?
Yeah. You can thank California for these mandates, basically.
Right.
And Al Gore.
Well,
and his cape.
Plus, our politicians. I don't think Al Gore has much to do with it anymore as we like to think, but...
He started it. He's a catalyst.
He started it. Well, somebody else would have started it if it weren't for him.
I doubt it. No one's that bored.
So, do we see a possible, you know, a big spike in vehicle costs at the expense of... Or, let me
that's
rephrase
what engineers
that.
Are saying.
Let me rephrase that. Do we see a drop in what you pay at the pump in exchange for a more expensive vehicle?
No.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if engineers are saying so, and even though that they're just probably, maybe it's just an aftershock and they're just like, God, we can't do it. It's too expensive. You know, maybe at the way it is now, but you look at, you know, the government is saying that, oh, you're going to save $8,000 a vehicle. It's like, yeah, bullshit. You're the only ones that are saying that.
And, yeah, that's tough to believe. I mean,
yeah, it's really tough to believe.
Well, this is again by what year again?
2025.
2025. So that
well, of course, like, you know, things like technology and things like it all tapers off. It all gets cheaper as
right.
as time
so
goes on.
So we have 14 years to go. My question is, what do you guys think? I mean, how many of GM's vehicles by 2025 will have or at least offer the Voltec powertrain or something like the Voltec powertrain.
Like some form of plug-in electricity?
Right.
Like some sort of drivetrain like that
plug-in? I'd say pretty much everything except for maybe the most heavy-duty vehicles out there.
You know the kind of revisions that the grid will need to have to support, you know, like what is the current automotive market like? Almost 11 million vehicles.
I think all you got to do is just spray some magical fairy dust on the grid, it'll work. It'll work just fine.
It's a terrible. The way that they implemented this is terrible. It's just a terrible way to do it. And
how would you do it? I mean, what do you?
I would go after more alternative fuels rather than just being like, okay, well, as far as gasoline cars go, or you know what, maybe that's the way it is. It's like you're electric in a hybrid, or you got to have amazing fuel economy. It's, well, what if I want to run my car on, I don't know, propane or
that's the problem though.
Or biodiesel.
I think
bioethanol.
Right, I hear you. I think it would make sense to do that in some areas, but the problem is that it won't work unless everyone standardizes on this stuff. I mean, the reason electric cars are becoming so prevalent now,
it's because everyone's standardizing
exactly,
and their subsidies.
Exactly. Not even subsidies, but everyone's standardizing on it. So, it makes it easier for the consumer to understand how they work, what they are, what they do. And I'll tell you what, even to this day, the Volt, in my experience in hanging around certain stores and certain dealerships, is still a mystery to most people. When we were speaking about sales numbers the other day, I mean, what, there's 100 Volts sold in all of July? I mean, that's like, the Leaf sold like 500, right? Or probably even more. So the Leaf outsold the Volt. The Volt, the Leaf is easy to understand. It's an electric vehicle. You plug it in. Yes, it's got limited range. So I think that standardization is important for multiple reasons. One is to get the industry in line with everything, in line with the new suppliers, the products that need to be created, that the technology that needs to be created for this to work, and it makes it easier for consumers to understand. Puts things in classes, if you will. Now this is the electric class, this is the gasoline class. The Volt's kind of in between right now, but I think that's necessary. So I don't think we can have this kind of plethora or very rich infrastructure of, well, you got ethanol over there and you got biofuels over there and then you got like
maybe like if it's across the board, but if you limit these certain fuels to like a certain segment, like say gas, like high octane gasoline, like derived from corn and from algae, that would be great in sports cars,
right?
Whereas
that's the thing, is that then you have to have people do research, and people don't like doing research. I think
there's money in research.
No, but consumers, when they're shopping for a car, there's a certain point where they say, screw this, I'm going to get a gas car. Or screw this, I'm going to get an electric car. I don't understand all this other stuff.
You know what I say? Screw them. Take the bus. You clearly don't give two craps about driving. Yeah, walk. Use a bike. The customer's always right. Well, you know what? I hate living by that rule, because I not once do I always think that, oh, hey, the customer's right. It's like, no, you shouldn't. If the customer does not like doing something, like, 9 out of 10 Americans, they don't care about driving. That's why we're terrible drivers.
That's why the most popular car sold in the United States and the world is the freaking Corolla.
Yeah, it's...
Sorry, in the world, not the United States.
It's ridiculous. Like, and they have all, we have all these regulations and things going towards like safety, and there's so much engineering and effort and research all going into the safety of cars, which is like, I'm
learn
all for safety.
Learn to drive.
But yeah, if we all knew how to drive a little bit better, we wouldn't need all these safety things, and therefore we wouldn't need all this extra
weight. I'll tell you what. I mean, even if that, I think that all boils down to, Manoli, I think at the end of the day, it boils down to personal responsibility. And when I'm going to work at 7:40 in the morning, and when I see at least
Americans
three
don't
morons,
like personal responsibility.
I see at least three morons almost run into me in Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this week because they were texting on the freaking highway.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, it's like, well, maybe you're right. Maybe the personal responsibility is not really the strength here. So we'll see. I think this is the cafe stuff is, it's an interesting development. Obviously, very lofty goals. But we'll see.
Well, the one thing I thought is that,
you know, for vehicles such as performance vehicles like the Corvette, the Camaro, their top engines, some of the trucks, you're going to see an a major increase in price for the gas pig. You know, now a lot of us see, you know, you get when you buy a vehicle, you get the gas guzzler taxes. That is nothing compared to what you're going to see when these CAFE numbers come into effect. You know, and it to some degree, it's not because these vehicles that are the gas pigs have an increase in engineering. It's actually a social engineering practice where it actually forces people to settle for the gas miser model.
Right. So, it just prices them out of the vehicle.
Exactly. And this is one of the things that some of these manufacturers or all of them will be forced to do. It's not something that they want to do. It's something that they're going to be forced to do. And as for when we're talking about gas prices, I think fuel companies, even though, you know, usually you take your general economic model with supply and demand, blah, blah, blah. But I think even though Americans may be actually consuming less oil, the price of oil will still increase because these guys are just greedy pigs. So don't think that, you know, if you have your 2010 Camaro 15 years from now, you're going to be able to buy cheap gas. It's going to go down to $2 a gallon again because nobody's buying it anymore. You're wrong. It'll be past $5 easily. So,
as the great economist Carl Johns once said, supply and demand rules everything except for when it doesn't.
So the other thing is, even if the price of gas did come down, the government's deficit and need to try and reduce the debt it has, you know, this will only give them an opportunity to put some kind of consumption tax on fuel to try and meet their financial needs. So, you know, it's going to have a huge impact to us. I'm hoping that, you know, these companies, and especially General Motors, are not going to totally go 100% towards Voltec technology, but also use like the e-assist stuff that they have now, increase regenerative braking, mm-hmm. Maybe look at solar cells on vehicles, obviously wind resistance, tires that reduce friction, and other products or components in the vehicle that can reduce friction, weight. All these things are going to have major impacts in terms of a company's ability to deliver these CAFE rules. So hopefully GM is well underway. I think if they're, you know, obviously if they feel secure about their decision, then, you know, they have their projects well underway, and we'll have to see. But, you know, like you said, we're not going to be driving these big Suburbans anymore unless
There are people that are going to need those cars, though.
Throw them in the trunk.
I come from a family of six. I come from a family of six, okay? So I'm always going to have it in my head. It's like, car like Sonic just wouldn't work for a family like mine.
Well, Manny, I think at that point, you have to ask yourself, I mean, does, can these CAFE regulations have a deeper effect on societal structure, you know, such as family structure and the amount of children, for instance, that a family may have?
If it does affect it in some way, I mean, it's terrible. It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, China's been, you know, limiting offering incentives to limit their familial reproduction.
This isn't China. This is America. One, two. It's America. And, you know, I hate to sound like brash and arrogant about it, but come on. So at one point we used to hold certain principles in place, and it just seems that we've kind of lost our way there.
We are wayfarers.
Yeah.
As and, the Volt commercial says.
And basically, if you guys got to think, it's like, how, like, what's the penalty on automotive companies? Like, how much money and development and stuff are they going to have to throw in to be able to meet a 5% annual increase in efficiency? Like, a lot of people don't understand how hard that is.
5% sounds like a small number.
It's really not. It's compounding.
Yeah, that's like the cruise today, right?
Yeah.
Think about that. That's like the cruise today, the 2011 cruise. Yeah. All of a sudden, you know, instead of, what does it make? Let's say 40 miles a gallon, right?
Yeah. Next year.
Next year, it has to make 42 miles a gallon. After that, 44.
Well, 40.
Actually, 40. Compounding. Yeah, you know, that's right. That's
so,
right.
So, yeah, this 5, it's just, it's going to get.
44.1.
It's just ridiculous. And it's just like every year. I mean, if you were to think about it for a second, it's just like, okay, I'm an engineer and I have exactly 1 year to squeeze 5% more of efficiency out of this engine. And
right.
We have to go back to formula. We have to look at all the parts. But you see, know, we might have to have suppliers develop and make new parts for us. And this all has to be like in a year timeline. That's nearly impossible.
Exactly. I mean, at that point, you're looking at, I think that's the worst part of this, the regulation here, you know,
engineers are so pissed off.
Right. The thing is that, imagine this, I mean, we're talking about mid-cycle refreshes, right? Updates. Mm-hmm. You're going to need pretty much a big overhaul, not a major overhaul, but a pretty big overhaul to make this happen, to squeeze this, you know, and at what expense is this going to come? I mean, we're going to have great fuel economy at the expense of what? Safety features?
Or you look at this. It's like, okay, well, obviously, you know, the way development works is not that new things come out every year. They come out like every 4 years, every 5-6 years. So, okay, let's take 4 years. 4 years down the window, we're going to have an all-new engine. It's going to be 20% more efficient than the current one. That's still really high, especially considering that engines, you know, in terms of fuel economy, are not much more efficient than they were in, say, the 80s or 90s. Mm-hmm. They're much cleaner.
Well,
and they're able to, and they're more powerful, and they're able to carry more weight while delivering the same fuel economy.
I'll tell you what,
but it's that fuel economy number everyone looks at. It's like, okay, well, clearly the engineers can do better than this because they've been lax, they've been lazy. It's like, no BS, they've been lax and lazy. Look at all the extra stuff they've had to fit in alongside with providing that good fuel economy number. It's like, it's just ridiculous.
Well, you have revised crash test safety ratings now.
Yeah,
now
it's just
it's
above and beyond. Like,
but the funny thing is that consumers still want good horsepower or good fuel economy, excuse me, and they want, you know, a vehicle that makes 1,000 horsepower. You know, they still want that. So it's like at that point, you know, and maybe by the time 2025 rolls around, I think we'll all be driving these little GM ENVs, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, it's a terrible thought, but it's incredibly plausible.
Religious
and references. That's the scary part. That's the worst part.
Yeah.
And I think to Manoli's comment about, you know, big families, you know, we're going to have to give up style and comfort to be able to, you know, like I said, like I'm a family of five. So, you know, but the larger families, it's like, I don't know if you've ever been to overseas in the Asian markets, but, you know, their vans are like, I don't know if you know the Mitsubishi Delica. It's like the first version of the Toyota Sienna.
Right.
It's like this cab over the engine type of deal, and very thin vehicle.
I think Nissan had one as well.
Yeah, like the Daihatsu and all those companies have similar stuff. But you know, they're very thin type of vehicles. Kind of looks like the old Volkswagen mini bus from maybe 15 years ago.
Vanagon.
Yeah, the ugly friggin' minivans. They're a little tall and skinny things, and they'll carry, you know, 7-8 people, but you're pretty squished in them.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, maybe we're definitely going to have to compromise the size of our vehicles in order for them to accomplish it. Now, maybe, you know, they're going to be able to offer a Suburban in all carbon fiber and aluminum to get, you know, cut the weight in half.
For a million bucks.
You can imagine. Right. You know, so that's the compromise. So,
you know,
it'll really be interesting to see what kind of solution that, you know, General Motors is going to have.
Here's all I care about. You know, in 2013 or whenever my cruise lease expires, I'm going to be getting myself a Camaro. Okay. And at that point, the government can pry my Camaro out of my kung fu freaking strong grip for all I care, but it ain't going nowhere. That's all I got to say.
Well, it's like,
yeah, honestly, but you know what
are they going to do about classic cars?
Well,
you know, high tax. Are they going to mandate those two?
High tax. Have fun registering it.
The hobby tax. No, it's going to be called the hobby tax.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But antique. Generally,
yeah.
Well, generally, whatever cars, in the past, they've never gone back to cars that, you know, have entered the market a certain
right.
way that
Heck,
today it's like, for example, you know, the 1930s, well, there's no seatbelts in them. Well, you still don't have to have seatbelts.
Right. Right.
So,
well, the funny thing is, I think at that point, you know, weight, it's going to become, the cars are going to become so much lighter that if you drive
yeah.
a 2010 Camaro down the street at that point, you may create a groove, you know, in the cement or in the pavement, but we'll see.
Well, the thing is, when you said nobody's friggin' moving your Camaro. Well, if gas is $8 a gallon, you won't be either.
I'll be moving it. I'll siphon it out of the gas station for all I care. You know.
So anyways, it's a real dilemma. It's really going to affect our lives, especially around the automobile. You know, it's such the looks of an automobile, the design of an automobile. It, you know, plays such an important part to North America. You know, we fall in love with our vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Sex sells, baby.
And so, you know, it's going to have a huge impact on, you know, a designer's ability to deliver an attractive product for a reasonable price.
I'm telling you, so, GM ENV, that's where we're going to be driving. Is it the NV or the ENV? I still can't figure that out. Manny, do you know?
ENV.
ENV. All right. Well, I think that will do it for today. We're going to let these good people go. And guys, thank you so much for being
here. Grant, it's coming 2013.
Well, okay, enough of that. We're going to talk about that next show. You hooligan. Such a hooligan.
Aren't I?
As we do at the end of every show, we're going to welcome.
Alex thinks it should be a Chev.
Yep, I definitely do.
I'm looking forward to GMC Conquest buyers.
I'll give you Conquest right here. As we do at the end of every show, you know, it's really difficult to laugh, Manali, when you have a cracked lip, you know, as I do now.
Do you have a cold sore again?
No, cold sore.
Oh, yeah. Then what happened?
I think you gave that to me last time.
Oh,
in
New
York?
I'm sorry.
That's what happens.
While you were sleeping.
You try to get me and I bring the both of us down, you know, it just kind of happens that way. as we do at the end of every show, we're going to welcome Bob Lutz or any other member of the GM authority, of the GM crew, anyone who works for General Motors. We'd love to have you on. If you're in engineering, if you're in marketing, if you're in anything in between, we'd love to have you, here on the GM Authority weekly show. And, you can call in, you can contact us, you can write into us. You can do all of that by writing to podcast@gmauthority.com. Or calling us at 313-355-3GMA. That's 313-355-3GMA. You can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/GM Authority. You can also follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/GM Authority. And also, do leave us a review in the iTunes store, would you? We really appreciate those, and we really haven't been getting enough of those. So, hop on it. And that's all I got for today. That's all I got for today because the general has been served. Please rate the show in the iTunes store. Head on over to iTunes and search for GM Authority Weekly.